The BBC presents My Word. And here to introduce the program and the panel is Jack Longland.
My Word is a word game played by people whose business is words. And this program comes to you from the Newhall Community Centre, Weybridge in Surrey. Those taking part are Anne Scott James, Lillis Powell, Frank Muir, and Dennis Norton. And here's round one to try and test their vocabularies. 2 marks if they get the meaning of these words right. We begin with Anne Scott James. Anne, what is sesame? S-E-S-A-M-E.
Well, we've all heard of open sesame, haven't we?
Yes.
It's also, I'm sure, Middle Eastern. It's a sort of seed or pod which you grind, crush, or distill.
Yes, except as far as I know the last, you're absolutely right. 2 marks. It's an annual, herbaceous, tropical or subtropical plant with seeds. Open sesame was this magical spell by which Ali Baba got into the cave. Well, now on to Frank Muir. What the meaning of unbosom?
Well, Amazons used to semi-unbosom. Semi-unbosom themselves because they used to remove, the ladies used to remove one in order to facilitate throwing a spear or pulling a bow and arrow. If you're... To unbosom means to reveal the secrets of your heart.
Yes. Yes. That'll do, I think, Frank. 2 marks it is. To disclose or to reveal, and to unbosom yourself is to reveal your innermost and secret thoughts. Dennis Powell, what is a tyro? T-Y-R-O, or it can be T-I-R-O. Tyro.
It's a kind of beginner, somebody doesn't know a great deal about something.
No, hold on. 2 marks. Beginner or learner in anything, a novice. Dennis Norton, what is a tick per longer?
Tick per longer is the Mark II version of the tick per, which was too short.
Try Southeast Asia.
It's a venomous serpent, mainly found in Ceylon and India, and it's a word which means a spot viper, because it's covered with spots. Sorry. Well, now, before we begin round two, I give each team a quotation for them to write down, and I hope that the two women members of the team will go on studying those quotations till the end, because then I shall ask them for the source of the quotations. Anne Scott James and Dennis Norton, here's your quotation. Events repeat themselves. And Dillis Power with Frank, yours is, the lamps are going out all over Europe. At the end of the program, I shall ask Dennis and Frank to give me their ideas of how these came to be said or written. Round two is about legend and mythology, and 2 marks, possible total. Anne Scott James, of what was Themis the goddess? T-H-E-M-I-S. What was she goddess of?
Retribution, wasn't she?
You're very near there.
She was the goddess of something which, what you got as a result of your actions,
yes,
wasn't she?
Yes, yes.
But I cannot remember if they were fortunate actions.
Well, look at that girl with the scales and the blindfold things and
justice.
All that.
Justice.
Themis was goddess of law and order and justice and the general concept of divine justice in all its relations to man, and she was the daughter of heaven and earth. Frank Muir, Sisyphus was said to have built Corinth, and he became its first king. He did various good things, like promoting commerce and navigation, which was supposed to be very fraudulent and greedy in his dealings. And eventually he was punished by the gods. How was Sisyphus punished?
Well, Sisyphus, like lots of Greeks, invented various parts of the Olympic Games. And the game that Sisyphus invented was pushing a peanut up a hill with your nose.
Yeah.
His punishment was to push a block of a stone, a sort of stone thing, presumably a stone ball, up a hill, and when it got to the top it rolled back and he had to push it up again.
Absolutely.
His short nose.
Absolutely right, Frank. You get your 2 marks. He had forever to roll this block of stone to the top of the hill, and he never got it quite to the top, and it always rolled back down again, and he's doing it still.
If you're listening, Sisyphus, our hearts go out to you. Good luck, lad. Keep pushing there.
And here is the record you requested.
It's Rolling Stones.
Well, now, dear Lisbeth, Mithridates the Great was a king of great ability and great energy, but in his youth he was the object of continual intrigue and plotting by his courtiers. And what were the preventive methods that he took against them?
Didn't it something to do with poison?
Yes.
He had somebody who sort of took poison for him, I think.
Well, no, every king did that.
Oh, wow.
King's taster.
He tried all kinds of poison. And got used to them.
Yes, two marks. Mithridates the Great. He studied all sorts of poisons and venomous plants and gave himself tiny but repeated doses of all these poisons, and because of that he built up a resistance inside himself to all known poisons and so couldn't be poisoned. Dennis Norden, who rode Pegasus, the winged horse, and slew the Chimera according to Greek legend?
Who rode
Pegasus?
He was a trainer. What's the name? Amphitryon? No, it was
not quite.
It was Bellerophon.
Quite right. Absolutely right. Well, the next round's about verse and poetry. What I do is to give each member of each team a quotation and ask them to complete it with the next line or two. Two marks if they can complete the quotation, and two more if they can name its source. Anne Scott James, ill fares the land to hastening ills a prey.
Goldsmith, I think.
Yes, quite right.
Now, come on, I mean, all you've
deserted
got to do
village.
Is... But all you've got to do is do the
yes.
next line, Dennis.
Yes.
That's pie. I mean, I've done
I
the work.
No, well, it's just...
Deserted village is quite right.
It's something about something's values decay. Or
yes, right.
Something
yes, you've got almost the whole thing.
Brilliant.
Three out of four, certainly. Oliver Goldsmith's deserted village, ill fares the land to hastening ills a prey, where wealth accumulates and men decay. So you've got most of that line. Frank Muir, standing on the bridge at midnight, she says farewell, blighted love.
It's a ballad.
Hmm.
Start again.
She's honest, yes.
Yes. See him in the House of Commons, passing lawyers to put down crime, while she's lying in the gutter. Isn't it something shame?
Splendid, Frank, but author?
There's sort of spontaneous combustion. Yeah. Nobody sort of sits down and writes.
I'll give you one and a half out of
Trad.
It's anonymous, and as the Oxford Dictionary of Quotations says neatly, there are many versions. This particular verse runs like this. Standing on the bridge at midnight, she says, farewell, blighted love. There's a scream, a splash, good heavens, what is she a-doing of?
She's actually a doing of herself in. Poor thing.
Now, dear Lisbeth, if you prick us, do we not bleed? If you tickle us, do we not laugh? If you poison us, do we not die?
Well, it's The Merchant of Venice.
Yes.
And it's spoken by Shylock.
Yes.
If you starve us, do we not hunger?
Mm.
Freedom from hunger.
Right.
I don't know.
It's Shylock in Shakespeare's Merchant of Venice. In the long speech, which keeps on saying, let him look to his bond, where he's going to have his revenge on the merchant.
Does Bond go back that far?
If you prick us, do we not bleed? If you tickle us, do we not laugh? If you poison us, do we not die? And if you wrong us, shall we not revenge? Now, Dennis Norden, there's a great text in Galatians, once you trip on it, entails...
It's easy to trip on anything when you're in tails. There's a great text in Galatians.
Once you trip on it, entails.
Once you trip on it, entails. Sounds like Kipling.
No, it's earlier than Kipling, but I quite understand the reference. She's quite a sort of near one.
Great text in Galatians. Great text in Galatians. once you trip on it entails doing 47 press-ups in the Dance of the Seven Veils. It's not Kipling. Well, is it roundabout? Is it Byron?
No, between the two. You're bracketed the target.
Byron.
Chap Browning. Yes, quite right.
I don't know where it comes from or what happens next.
It's Browning's soliloquy of the Spanish cloister, where one monk is very, very angry with another one and doing his best to do him down. There's a great text in Galatians, once you trip on it, entails 29 distinct damnations, one sure if another fails. And now a round of origins and derivations. 3 marks, if members of the team can first of all define the present meaning of this word or phrase, and go on then to say its origin, what it's derived from. Anne Scott James, he knows the ropes.
Well, it means he's a sort of smart cookie who knows his way around.
Yes.
I should have thought it came from sailing.
It does. Mm. Up to all the tricks of the trade, knows the condition of some particular sphere of action. Comes from navy or sailing in the days of sail. You couldn't be called an able-bodied seaman if you didn't know all the ropes on the sailing ship and how to use them and the knots to be used in the right places. 3 marks. Frank Muir, platonic love.
It means a very sincere affection, which is nonsensual.
Yes.
An affection of admiration and noble virtues and intellectual affinities and so forth. And comes from Plato's writings.
Yes, which particular book?
It's really the fact that very intelligent men in early Greece, such as Socrates, had
yes.
Very intelligent youths.
Yes, yes.
And they had a very real affection between them, which is called Platonic.
Yes, sir?
Whether it...
That's... yes, that's good enough, Frank. That's a very good definition. I'll give you your 3 marks. It means a mutual love and esteem between people, free from any passion or carnal desire. And that's normally now applied to that kind of relationship between man and woman. In Plato, this was the relation between men and youths, and Socrates was the great example of this being entirely a matter of virtue and knowledge and beauty, and not sensual at all. Hence, Platonic love. 3 marks. So, Miss Powell, what was a foot pad and why?
A foot pad was a thief on foot.
Mm-hmm.
And he padded along on foot.
Well, so now, today, yesterday, tomorrow?
Oh, in the 18th century.
Yeah. And contrasted with?
The highwayman who rode on a horse.
That'll do. Yes, I think that's all right. 3 marks. An unmounted highwayman who, on the whole, therefore, preyed upon pedestrians rather than chaps in coaches or on horses, and about a century or so ago. Some people think that he wore a particular kind of sort of sneaker, that is, a padded footgear, so he didn't make any noise and came up behind these unfortunate chaps very quietly indeed, hence foot pad. 3 marks. Dennis Norden, what is an Albert and why?
Albert is an old-fashioned watch. No, it isn't a watch. It's the chain.
Yes.
It wouldn't give you tuppence for your old watch chain, that one. And I presume it was Prince Albert.
Yes? You're presuming absolutely right.
Because he wore it, I suppose.
He did? It's a watch chain worn across the waistcoat from one pocket to another, or to a buttonhole in the middle. That's, I think, an option. Prince Albert, Prince Consort of Victoria, went to Birmingham in 1849 and was given a gold chain by the jewelers of the city for his watch. And this particular fashion of wearing it right across your either prominent or not stomach caught public fancy, and soon everyone was wearing them, and they were named after the Prince Consort. And now we come to the last round and go back to those quotations I gave the two teams earlier on in the program. 2 marks, Anne Scott James. Can you give me the origin of your quotation? Events repeat themselves.
Well, when I was a baby, which makes it practically 19th century, Nanny had two great phrases. One was, it takes all sorts to make a world, and the other was, events repeat themselves. So I regard it as a nursery proverb.
Well, half a mark for having a nice nanny.
Otherwise, it might be some historian.
Yes, I think that's more like it.
Not Gibbon. I've tried Tacitus.
You're getting nearer, but I think if I let you guess all the Roman historians, it wouldn't be fair.
Roman historian?
Plutarch. From Plutarch's Lives, though it also turns up later on, it probably turns up lots of times, because it's a very familiar phrase, as your nanny knew, repeated by Montaigne in France later on. Events repeat themselves. Now, Dillis Power, will you give me the origin of your quotation, which was, the lamps are going out all over Europe.
It was said by Lord Grey at the beginning of the First World War.
He wasn't Lord.
Sir Edward Grey.
That's it, thank
you. Sir Edward Grey.
And what was he referring to?
Well, he was referring to the fact that war was breaking out.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Sir Edward Grey was Foreign Secretary at the outbreak of the First World War, and on, I think, the 3rd of August, he was standing in the window of one of the windows of the Foreign Office and watching the lamps being put out over London, and said, the lamps are going out all over Europe. We shall not see them lit again in our lifetime. 2 marks. Well, now I'm going to ask Frank and Dennis to give me their explanations of how these quotations came into being, and on this occasion, the marks will go to whichever incredible explanation receives the longer amount of applause from the audience here in the theatre. So, back, first of all, to Dennis Norden and his quotation, events repeat themselves.
Do you know the definition of nutch getter? Nutch getter is the reply you get if you ask a ventriloquist doll about the state of its health. Now, I happen to know this because at an early stage of my career, I worked in a very junior capacity in the office of a theatrical booking agent. And this is how I came to be acquainted with the very attractive lady who was known around all the working men's clubs in the north as Lola Montez, the only accordion-playing nude. Now, if you think about this type of act, which I invite you to do, for the lady concerned, it not only demands a certain amount of musical skill, but it can be very painful. Which is why one day Lola came to my office and she said, I want to change my act. I want to be a vent. A vent is the show business term for a ventriloquist. And I said, but surely you can't just become a vent overnight. And she said, look. And she took out of a long suitcase that she had by her the most exquisite and lifelike dummy that I'd ever seen, and she said, how are you today, Johnny? And in a very deep voice, and without her lips moving at all as far as I could see, the dummy replied, much better. And I said, that's really very good. How do you do it? And the dummy replied, well, to be absolutely frank with you, I'm a midget. And it was absolutely true. He was. Very nice chap, 3'6". And I saw that here really was were stars of the future, and I set them on their way. And had it not been for a very well-known show business axiom, which says that lady ventriloquists are their own worst enemy, they would be TV stars with their own series today. But Lola fouled it up. You see, she insisted that in order to maintain the secret of their act, in order to maintain the fiction, that Jonathan should remain always with her by her side as a dummy. In other words, this meant that whenever they had to go out anywhere, he would go in the suitcase. Similarly, she would always keep him in her dressing room or in the same room as she had at the Digs. And I saw trouble brewing. And the tragedy finally happened, as they always do, at the very worst possible time. And that was when they were invited to play at the Royal Command performance. And they came on to a thunderous ovation from this most distinguished audience. And they sat down and she put him on her knee, and I could see he was emotionally disturbed. She was looking particularly voluptuous that night. And she said, "Well, how are you feeling today, Johnny?" And he said, "You're driving me mad. We can't go on meeting like this." There was a kind of little murmur and stir from the cheaper seats. The 15-guinea ones. And she was a bit disconcerted, but she went on and she said, "What did you learn at school today, Johnny?" And he said, "I want you. You know, I want you. We could make the earth shake." And he buried his face in her ear. And there were now clamours from the audience. And one peeress shouted out, "That ain't no dummy, it's a perishing midget." Well, of course, it was the end of their career. Plutarch said that events repeat themselves. It's even truer that lady ventriloquists are their own worst enemies. Or as we say in the business, she vents defeat themselves.
Remove my faith, I shall never believe a ventriloquist act again. And now we go on to Frank Muir, and if you remember, his quotation was, "The lamps are going out all over Europe."
The most unforgettable character I've ever known was old, he's dead now. And his story is a sad one, an illustration of this, of the jest that life is. The jest of life, really, is that we always want to do and want to be what we're not equipped to do or be. I was no good with human beings. I was marvellous with animals. I always have been. They cluster around me, sniffing my legs. If I go for a walk, they come back with a nest of field mice in my turnips. I've only got to sleep in the open and ladybirds settle on me. It looks as though I've got raving measles. He was the other way round. He desperately wanted to be a vet, this boy. He was my age. He loved animals. I mean, animals loathed him. He used to hold out his left hand for dogs to sniff. When I knew him, he was about 17, and the fingers on his left hand were half an inch shorter than those. Honestly, animals bit him so much that, stripped for gym, he looked deckle-edged. I met him again after the war. He was sort of middle-aged before his time. And sort of shambly, he had one of those gingery, very thick tweed suits with sort of bits in them, as though it was woven from marmalade. Thin, almost emaciated hair. And he was... And he had one arm, apparently. What had happened was, whenever he saw an animal, he always wanted to make it say, "Ah," and take its temperature. And there was this robin, you see. One blow of its wing, and it broke his arm, and had to have it moved. He was actually up a ladder at the time. It was an apple tree, and he said, "Say ah" to the robin, whom he thought looked a bit flushed, and the robin flapped its wing and dislodged an apple which fell on his fingers, and he fell off. Anyway, he was no arm. And then I heard that he tried very hard to make friends with animals and comfort them when he felt they were ill. And he went even down to milder animals. He gave up dogs. He got down to lambs. He thought that he'd be fairly safe from physical injury ministering to lambs. And he was on this patch of grass, and there were these lambs, and he bent down, and getting out his little spatula, It's actually a lolly stick, but... he said, say ah, but what he didn't know was behind him was the ewe. The ewe, seeing the lamb attacked, well, just butted my friend, whose name was Oliver Sinclair Yarrup. Wasn't the butt that hurt him, it was the landing, because it took rather a long time. He got quite a lot of velocity up by the time it happened. As the coroner said, what he was doing on the edge of Beachy Head with only one arm. And so my friend perished. But I feel, you know, if there is a hereafter, and I think there is, then he will be looked after. And I see him in green fields among sheep and ewes and lambs. And if there is a paradise, the lambs are going, ah, to Oliver Yarrup.
Well, that's just what our dog thinks about our vet, but never mind. And that brings us to a final score in which Frank Muir wins the contest of the two stories, and his team of Dillis Powell and Frank Muir win by one half of a mark from Anne Scott James and Dennis Norton. And it also brings to an end this edition of My Word.
In My Word, you heard Dillis Powell, Anne Scott James, Frank Muir, and Dennis Norton, introduced by Jack Longland. The program was devised by Tony Schreien and Edward J. Mason, and presented by the BBC.